This is Mark Hoffmar, and you're listening to the FSF Popcast.
Hello, guys, and welcome to the FSF Popcast. I'm Tim, I'm your host, and of course, Kathleen is here with me. Our guest today is a writer and producer of some amazingly popular shows and movies, including Spider-Man animations. There's several different forms of that. There's Power Rangers, there's DreamWorks Dragons, Lego Nexo Knights, many, many other things that we don't have the time or the ability to read them all. There's so many. There's really cool stuff. But we're really excited to have him here today to talk nerdy with him. And that, of course, is the one, the only, Mark Hoffmar. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Kathleen. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. I'm really very excited because, you know, one of the things is when I start looking at people's resumes, this is what I do before I reach out to somebody. I'll start looking at their resume, what they've been involved in, what they've done. And I started going through your stuff and I'm like, oh, I want to talk about that. Oh, I want to talk about that. Oh, because, you know, and then a portion of it was, I watched that as a kid. I watched that as a kid. I watched that as a kid. I watched that with my kids. I watched, you know.
Yeah, which is fun. You know, it's fun. I do. I've gone back to doing stand up after, you know, taking a like 30-year break to have get married and have kids and you know, do other things. So I've gone back to it, but I tell a bunch of Hanna-Barbera stories, and I remember the first time I was going to tell them, I thought, you know, do people remember these characters? Is this going to just feel dumb? And no, it went over big, and I had a guy come up to me afterwards, and he says, you got to work Quick Draw McGraw into that story. And I was like, how old are you? And he's like, I'm 31. I said, how do you know Quick Draw McGraw? And he said, right, Boomerang. Yeah. Right, Boomerang. And I was like, oh
yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, they
played a lot of that stuff. Right? So I was like, oh, okay, these characters have stayed alive. So I was like, okay.
And yeah, that's very cool.
I was at a stand-up show this past Friday. I was in the audience, and the comedian was doing crowd work. He was asking people what they did for a living. He pointed, what do you do, sir? I said, I'm a writer. He goes, so have you written anything? I said, well, I wrote on Spider-Man, the animated series, and for Power Rangers. And the audience actually spontaneously applauded. And I was sort of like taken aback. I was sort of like, really? Just that, right? You know, like, does that deserve a round of applause? I don't know, maybe. But I feel like it's kind of nice that I'm, you know, when I say I wrote on the first three seasons of Power Rangers, that it's like in a nice nook in the cultural zeitgeist of where people remember it and remember it fondly, and you know,
absolutely.
To hear stories about it, you know.
Absolutely. You know, because I was of the age of where I think I was either a sophomore becoming a junior in high school when Power Rangers came out. And I remember at first, a lot of the guys that I hung out with all panned it and made fun of it. You know, that it was, oh, this is a show for kids. It's stupid. It's, you know, it's too campy. It's this, it's whatever. You know what they all watch now?
Power Rangers. So, yeah. I mean, the weird thing to me was when the Tony Oliver, who was the first producer of the show, asked me about wanting to write for it. I said, well, I grew up in Honolulu, and in Honolulu, we had Channel 13, and Channel 13 was the Japanese channel. And so you would get all these crazy Japanese kids shows, that my brother and I would watch with subtitles. And it was Kamen Rider, and it was Kikaida, and it was, you know, stuff like this, like the Sentai Rangers, which is what Power Rangers is based on. And so I was sort of familiar with, you know, they're strongly formatted. They have a lot of goofy creatures in it. And so I was like, sort of like, yeah, I'm into this. That could be really fun. And then the very first meeting for Power Rangers was pretty crazy. Can I tell you about that one?
Oh, absolutely. We love stories.
Okay. So fortunately, like I said, this was around the era where I was still doing, improv, and I was still doing a lot of comedy, and now I'm back to doing comedy and improv. And so I get called into this meeting with Tony Oliver calls me in, and Haim Saban is in the room, and there's a director and another producer type and a production manager and a visual guy. And so we watched like 10 minutes of the Sentai Rangers. So they would always take an episode and they'd clip out like, you know, 6 to 10 minutes that you could then use to build your new episode, and then we'd write a new A plot featuring the American Rangers to fight whatever. So we're watching this thing. There's a giant, what looks like a pineapple with tentacles, and it's on the beach, and there's craziness happening, and they're fighting it, right? And we watch this footage. I have not been briefed on what to expect in this meeting. And Haim Saban turns to me and goes, "So, Mark, what would the story be?" And I was like, well, obviously he's a clown. He's a clown. He's an evil clown. And his name is Pineapple. Pineapple the clown. Oh, okay. Does he become a monster? Yes, he becomes a giant pineapple. And with tentacles. He's the pine octopus. That's what he is, right? And I'm like, well, what powers would he have? And I was like, he's got the powers to make people two-dimensional. And Haim turns to like the production guy and he goes, "Can we do that?" "Yeah, sure. We'll get him to freeze on screen, and then we'll get a picture of him, and we'll put it on foam core, and then we'll put that in there." And then, good. How does he get them back, Mark? We can't leave them frozen, right? I'm like, they throw a bucket of water on them, because we discover that he makes them two dimensional by sucking out, by dehydrating them. And I like bluff my way through that first thing, just using my improv skills. And I remember getting out of the meeting and I turned to Tony Oliver. I said, "Tony, okay, next time we have one of these meetings, you have to bring me in like a half hour early. I'll watch the footage and I'll just write down a bunch of ideas so that I'm not like having to have this, like making this stuff up on the fly like that." But so that was my first Power Rangers episode I wrote featured Pineapple the Clown.
That's fantastic. I love the fact that you're just like, "Yeah, so it's a big bad pineapple and he's going to freeze people." And they're like, "Yeah, let's do that. That sounds great."
Good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. I mean, so that it was very, very funny. And what was funny also on that, well, not funny for the guy, but on that episode. So in the first season of Power Rangers, it was done non-union. It was very low cost. So they would shoot 4 episodes in 10 days. They would do these 4 packs of shootings. And so if they had everything, if it was all in the at the juice bar, they'd shoot all the scenes at the juice bar on like Monday in the morning and for all 4 episodes, right? Or they'd try, right? And I remember that particular episode because I had written it as written a backyard fair, and instead they turned it into a carnival with like, they had a little Ferris wheel and like a scrambler ride and all kinds of stuff. The director went like a half day over on his shooting schedule and he got fired.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I was like, wow, you know. But yeah,
they were serious about that time budget then.
They were serious about that, yeah, especially back in the early days. The other interesting thing in the early days, the first season of that show, there was an accident when they had finished filming the episodes in Japan, and so they were shipping those season's monster costumes and the other costumes over in a shipping container, and something happened on the cargo ship. It got opened. They got sprayed with a chemical. They were ruined. They couldn't use them. So that first season, we couldn't film any additional footage because the rest of the years we would shoot, you'd shoot insert shots and film, and we would usually create our own evil bad guys. That's why the first few seasons, it was Rita the Witch and we had to match lip flap on her talking. But I remember they did an episode of that featured a villain called the Pudgy Pig, and they absolutely had to have a shot where the Pudgy Pig is sneaking up on the Power Rangers. And they didn't know what to do till I think it was either the director or the cameraman came up with the idea of they cut out a silhouette of the Pudgy Pig out of cardboard and they put it in front of a 5K light and they shined it on a dark piece of the back of the soundstage and they moved it like it was the shadow of the Pudgy Pig sneaking up on the Power Rangers from behind the building. And that's how they got away with that on that. So, yeah.
That's really
and
cool.
And that was Power Rangers the early days. Yeah.
That's fantastic. All right. So one of the things that we love, Mark, is to find out what makes people who they are, what they are, how they got to be where they are, all those type of things. Now you told us a little bit about you and your brother and, you know, some of the stuff that you were watching when you were growing up in Hawaii. But what were your influences that made you want to become a writer and producer?
I think I always liked entertaining people. I was usually sort of the class clown. I was very good with, I have a good ear, so I'm good with voices and doing impersonations. So I was constantly impersonating, you know, classmates and teachers. And And I got into drama, but I was also always writing. I liked writing stories. I wrote a lot for the school newspaper. I did that both in high school and in college. I enjoyed it immensely. And so, you know, it just became a natural. I sort of knew early on that I thought I wanted to write. And when I got to Los Angeles to start my career, I was both trying to write. I had a day job at Hanna-Barbera, but I was trying to write, and I was also doing improv and comedy. And I met with some of my actor friends, and it seemed to me that being an actor was a lot harder than being a writer. More people I knew that were writers were actually, you know, making a living at it. And so I decided to put my emphasis into the writing end of it. And so at Hanna-Barbera, my first job was as a publicist. And so okay. I did a lot of publicity for the voice actors. So I got to meet a lot of voice actors. I got to do publicity for the great Frank Welker.
Cool.
I got to do publicity and meet Jonathan Winters, which was fantastic. Tim Matheson came in a couple of times because nice. He was the original voice of Johnny Quest, which a lot of people didn't
know. Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So, because he was a child actor, right? He'd started as a child. So he was the original voice of Johnny Quest. So when we did a new series of Johnny Quests, I had set up a publicity thing where the new voice could meet the old voice. And he came in, and he was quite gracious about it, right? And they pretended to read a script standing next to a cutout of Johnny Quest. It was pretty neat. I had a lot of fun doing that, you know? So, and while I would do the publicity, I'd go home at night and I would write. So I would spec scripts. So it's called specking scripts, where you're just writing a script based mm-hmm. on a series you like or something you like to show what sure. you can do. So, you know, it was a lot of work, but I sort of knew that's what I wanted to do. So,
okay. Well, that's cool. It's kind of a neat progression there, to, you know, how you started here and then, you know, because a lot of times I think with writers, especially, I forget that many start with spec scripts and that's, you know,
yeah.
they're showing what they can do and how they can do. So what shows were you spec scripting?
Okay, this is going to give away my age. So I was specking Miami Vice.
Okay.
I was specking the original Equalizer television show. And I specked a show called Hooperman, which was one of the first dramedies on TV. I specked a Night Court. I did spec a nice. Night Court. I specked a movie that, and I had a partner at the time, so it helped. And my partner Judy and I wrote various things. We wrote a movie that was a sci-fi version of Robin Hood, which I still think is a good idea, but nothing's ever come of it, right?
You have my attention.
Yeah, right? It just, right, a dystopian future and a guy who's, you know, rises up out of the people and becomes their champion, right? So
I think it could be very cool.
I think it's a story that applies, right? So, although it's, now I look at it and I sort of go, it's, why can't I think of it? The girl with the bow, the series of movies based on the books.
Oh, Hunger Games?
Yeah, it's sort of Hunger Games now, right? You know, that was sort of the vision for the film. But then my writing partner got married and she moved out of town. And so I started getting offers to do spec scripts for Hanna-Barbera. So I started saying yes, because it was extra money and it was what I wanted to do. And then there was a group of creatives who left Universal to go work, or left Hanna-Barbera to go work at Universal, and I went with them. So my first writing job was working on staff at Universal. So that was great.
Okay, cool.
And driving around, I got to drive around the back lot at Universal in a little golf cart and pretend I was somebody. I learned a lot about how friction brakes on a golf cart don't work when you're going downhill on gravel. I actually learned that on the back lot at Universal.
Yeah, I bet you did.
Yeah. I was with my brother. Yeah, you have to stop the golf cart like Fred Flintstone, right? You have to put your feet out of the side of the car and actually get as much drag as you can.
Oh, it was pretty good shoes.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. or very rugged bare feet like Fred had.
Yes. Oh, goodness. So looking back at the list of shows that you've worked on, you got to work on Spider-Man, the animated series, an episode mm-hmm. of Silver Surfer, Spider-Man Unlimited, Spider-Man Secret Wars. And those are basically part of what the MCU was before we had the MCU now.
Right.
Honestly, it might have been kind of cooler back then. I don't know. It's complicated. There were things about it then that were cooler. There's things about now that are, yeah. But right. That actually, then those have gotten to come back to Marvel Animation for one of my daughter's favorite shows, Superhero Squad. So what is it about Marvel, or even Spider-Man in particular, that appeals to you as a writer? And would you be interested in taking another turn writing for Spidey for animation?
Well, you know, as a kid, of course, I read comics. So, and I was a Marvel kid. I was not a DC kid. So, and many times I would go from Hawaii to my grandparents, and my aunts and uncles lived in Iowa and Chicago. So I'd go back there, and I'd frequently buy comic books to read while we were on planes and stuff. Here was the weird part. A lot of times if I would buy comic books that had like two or three, you know, if it was a three-parter in a comic book, I would get back to Hawaii and I couldn't find the third part because shipping stuff to Hawaii was always catch as catch can. And we didn't have any dedicated comic book shops. You just had to go kind of get it at the local market. So there were actually some Marvel team-ups that I didn't get to finish the third part of the story till I got to college and got to a used comic book shop and dug through boxes and found it. Right. And I was like, I remember this. Right. You know, I could finally figure out what happens. So for me, it was like being able to write for Spider-Man and especially in the early days of Spider-Man, the animated series, working with Stan Lee in the room, those first, I want to say 10 episodes, we worked intensively with Stan. Some of them, they'd be 6-8 hour days where we'd be discussing story with Stan and Avi Arad, who was running Marvel at the time, and people from the network, and John Semper, who was the producer of the show, producer and head writer, who hired me. And so it was very, very special. And you'd be in these long meetings and you'd have these discussions about, you know, I remember having a discussion about, you know, they wanted Kraven the Hunter to be more poetic. So, you know, I started looking into, you know, Solzhenitsyn and some other Russian, you know, intellectual sources and poetry and stuff so that we could weave that in there to make it, you know. So they were taking this stuff very seriously. And it was always nice to be in the room and get Stan's perspective. Although I'll tell you a funny story about Kraven. One day at a lunch break, I was a young writer. I was about 26, 27. And I worked up the courage to talk to Stan. I said to Stan, we were working on the Kraven the Hunter script. I said, Kraven the Hunter, he's the world's bravest hunter, but you called him Kraven, which means cowardly. And Stan looks at me with a smile and goes, yes, Mark, but I spelled it with a K. And that was his explanation, right? It was like, it was like, fine. Okay. It works. Right.
But I spelled it with a K.
I spelled it with a K. And you know what was great for me is rolling off of that show, then I got to work. I've always been a gamer, so I got to roll into that and do Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions for Activision, which was really fun. And also sort of like it expanded on what we'd done. At least I looked at it as an expansion on what we'd done on Spider-Man, the animated series, with having multiple versions of Spider-Man. And in that one, that was my first exposure to Spider-Man noir. And I just fell in love with that world. I thought that world was great. I wish I was so happy to see that they brought it back in, in the new multiverse Spider-Man that he's in there, because when we made Shattered Dimensions, it was just super fun to experience that. And in fact, there's a tie-in to the series that I sort of did inadvertently, but it solved a story problem for us on Shattered Dimensions. Was there in Spider-Man the Animated Series, there's the Tablet of Time, which, you know, will make you immortal, and bad guys are after it. And Tombstone, as I recall, I think the Kingpin's after it, and he hires Tombstone, I think. And so I actually put another version of that tablet. We made up a version of that tablet, Tablet of Space and Dimension or something, to put in Shattered Dimensions. And that was so that who's his face? why can't I think of it? Fishbowl head bad guy.
Oh, Mysterio.
Mysterio, thank you. Yeah, I want to say Mephisto, but you're right, Mysterio. You know, he doesn't actually have any powers, right? He's an illusionist. That's his thing. So I had him stealing the tablet so that he could get actual power, and Spider-Man had to stop him by going across these dimensions and getting the tablet back. So that was really fun to be able to roll into a game and have that tie into the series.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it was. And the other nice thing was, you know, that series was set up from the beginning to be, we knew right from the get-go we were going to do 65 episodes. So the other nice thing, and this is all to, you know, John Semper's credit, is that he decided we were going to do multi-part episodes, right? So it's really very modern in terms of that outlook, because back then they liked doing, and almost every network liked doing it back then, they wanted to be able to have stories that you didn't need to watch two or three in a row. So you could jump into the show at any point in time, and you also didn't have to watch them in a particular order. And John right. kind of said, no, you know, I want to make it like comic books were made. And comic books were made as a, you know, where the story progressed, you know, and you remembered things. And he would even then theme, you know, whole seasons had their own themes, you know, Neogenic Nightmare, you know, and that was a whole, right? That was a whole thing. That was a theme for an entire season. So to me, that was very modern. It's like what you'd watch on streaming now, where you see the seasons with a theme, and even where a season might end with a cliffhanger. And we could do that because we knew we were going to do 65.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So actually, that game that you were just mentioning, Shattered Dimensions, is probably my favorite. And I've played a bunch of different Spider-Man games, but that one is actually my favorite because of Spider-Man Noir. He is right. the coolest character. And I loved in that game, you know, hiding in the shadows. And you know,
and you'd see the
yeah,
just, spider sense, yeah.
It was so cool. And I got to find that game, man. I want to play that again.
And he looked just cool with, you know, he's wearing Uncle Ben's old World War I flying cap. He's wearing this long duster jacket. And I remember there were shots of him with 245s. And I was like, this is just badass, right?
It's the complete opposite of what you think of with Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't the red and blue. It wasn't the black and white suit. It was just this black, dark suit. And, you know, the gunplay, which, you know, you'd never seen in any other type of Spider-Man.
Right.
And
right.
It was just a very cool take on Spider-Man. And for me, made that part of the game, because I liked all the versions of Spider-Man
right
in that game, but he stood out the most to me. And anytime I've ever talked to anybody about, well, what's your favorite version of Spider-Man? Spider-Man Noir. That's hands down. That's the one. And I didn't know you were involved with that till just now. So that's actually really very cool. That's a cool.
Yeah, time. It was really. And like I said, I remember falling in love with the Spider-Man Noir universe so much so that I think the Christmas I worked on that show, I went out and bought copies of Spider-Man Noir to give to all my fellow writers on Spider-Man, the animated series, even though the series had ended. I'm still very close with all the writing staff on that show.
Oh, cool.
And so I gave them all copies of it because I said, this is the coolest alternate version of Spider-Man that I've ever seen. I just think it was so well conceived. And, you know, it was, you know, Norman Osborn owns Coney Island, right? And it's just, you know, it was just really, really cool. I loved how they immersed it in the 30s and 40s. I thought it was great.
And the cool thing about that game, too, is I just pulled this up on Wikipedia, so I'm not pulling this out of my brain, but because there's not enough brain there to work this off of. But like the cast on that game was amazing. Neil Patrick Harris was Peter Parker. Christopher Daniel Barnes, who was the Peter Parker Spider-Man in your
animated series
show, in the animated series, was Spider-Man Noir, which is really very cool. You know, Dan Gilbazan.
Was
Miguel O'Hara. There's all these different really cool voice actors in this. John DiMaggio's in it, Steve Bloom, Jim Cummings, Nolan North is in it. Fred Tatasciore, Jennifer Hale, who's been on our show. You know, I mean, there's all these really cool. This is a very, very strongly casted game, and clearly
the producer wanted it to be connected to the roots of Spider-Man down through the ages. And that's why he also, what was fun was we wrote for that game too, then all the voiceover for Stan to connect it, you know, and we're back, true believers, to the next adventure, right? And so that it had the that the connective tissue was Stan doing it in the way he had done it for so many series in the 60s, right? In the
60s really cool.
and 70s, he did a lot of that voiceover stuff. So it was great. And Stan loved it, you know. And Kathleen, I was going to say, speaking of Superhero Squad, my I got to do the Superhero Squad games as well.
Oh.
And those were super fun to do. And of course, Stan got to come in and be the mayor of Superhero City, right? Because he was in the series. So he came in to do the recordings for the game. And he was so, I remember that he came in and I brought in my oldest son to meet Stan. I was going out to go to the bathroom and Stan was coming in down the hallway and I reintroduced myself and Stan, I worked for the, oh yes, Mark, how are you? And he was always very enthusiastic. And he looked at me and he said, Mark, this is a video game, right? I said, yes, Stan, it's a video game. Oh, well, I need to put on one of those suits with the ping pong balls. I was like, no, Stan, there's no mocap. It's all just voiceover. Oh, okay. But the fact that he was willing to put on a motion capture suit, do whatever, right? It was like he was always just so happy to be there and get something done, you know?
I love that so much. Like, the more stories I hear about Stan Lee, the more I'm like, oh, man, I love him so much.
Well, he was, you know, I was so happy. I got to speak about him at Comic-Con in 2019 on the Marvel animation panel. We were telling stories about Stan. And I actually got a little bit emotional because Stan reminded me a lot of my father and a lot of those people who come from the Great Depression era in that he always wanted to work. He never wanted to not have a job. You know, Stan would often say, my middle name is always available. That, you know, and always happy to work, always happy to be there, always curious and inquisitive. You know, he had very good instincts for stuff. You know, you can look at some of it and you're going, yeah, okay. Some of the dialogue's hokey, some of the fact that he used all this alliteration in the names. But, you know, he had a good reason for that. He was working on so many books back in the day that he would create names that were sort of mnemonic devices for, you know, Pepper Potts and Peter Parker. And, right, you know, it was easy for him to fall into that once he sort of had set that up. But his instincts were such a good sort of reaction against, you know, the Golden Age, you know, so he knew Spider-Man, I'm going to make him a high school kid and he's going to have all these issues at school and sort of being a science nerd and along with being a superhero and how does he balance that out? And it's brilliant and it's very modern. And it basically came from his just internal sense that I want to give this kid, you know, he has to have a real life, you know?
Yeah. And I think that makes so many of the superheroes as relatable as they are too, is the,
right.
They were so well written. They had so many different aspects other than just being a superhero. Like you said, he's a kid, but he's also Spider-Man.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And so it's, and that's why I think it also works too, when you make a different version of Spider-Man, if you keep that same thing where he's got a personal life and a superhero life, it becomes, you know, and I think that's sort of the paradigm now of how you do it right, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely.
I think that paradigm is one of the things I enjoyed most with the two most recent animated Spider-Man movies, you know, the Into the Spider-Verse. Is I think they did that really well. They showed the struggles of being, especially with the Miles Morales portion of it, the struggles of being trying to be an everyday kid, the kid of a cop, all these different things, stuff he's going through at school, plus trying to be the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man and do all the things that Spider-Man does. And, you know, and I thought they did a really good job of tying those two things together. And, you know, and then, of course, working in the other Spider-Mans.
Well, and I think,
Spider-Man,
you know, hey,
Spider Pig.
Yeah. You know, that's what was so fun about Shattered Dimensions too, that they let me use Peter Parker, because I had said, you know, can we have a post credit scene? And, you know, we've introduced all these other Spider-Men. And I think there's a scene early on in that game where Peter Parker meets Madame Web and he's looking at all these different versions of Spider-Man, and not all of them are in the game. You see, like, and I think he points at one and goes, is that a pig? And she's like, never mind that now, right? You know, and and then at the end he shows up, you know, Peter Parker shows, am I too late? You know, and it's like, because I had wanted to do these post-credit scenes because I thought that was kind of a thing they were doing with Marvel. So I just thought that was really, really fun. And I was so happy that they, you know, a lot of times those are the kinds of things that fall out of the budget and they decide, yeah, we just don't have time to do that. But I've been very fortunate in that in both getting to do Lego versions of the Marvel characters and Superhero Squad versions of the Marvel characters, that I've gotten to play in that sandbox of not having to take them too seriously, right? Getting to have fun with them.
Right.
And particularly when I would do the Lego stuff that featured the Avengers, I did the Avengers Reanimated Special, which I still, it's one of my favorite pieces, but I would always get a note from Marvel that you're pushing Thor. Thor is a little bit too much, right? And I'm always like, but yeah, that's the fun of Thor, right? You know, and, you know, but I got away with stuff that I didn't think they'd let me get away with, you know, reheating meatballs for a party with his hammer, you know, and, right. You know, carving, making ice sculptures of the Avengers, right. Stuff like that. And they left that in that. Like, okay. Okay.
Well, I think Lego has the opportunity to get away with a lot more because it is Lego. And, yeah. You know, I would never play a Lego game,
but, yeah, exactly. Right.
But yeah. But you know, even with like Kathleen's daughter, absolutely loves Darth Vader because she thinks he's funny.
Right. You know, right.
She's five and she thinks Darth Vader's funny. I'm like, well, kid, once you get used to the non-Lego version, you might have a different take, but.
Right. But, you know, I've always said that what's great about Lego is family friendly snark. Right. And so, you know, like all the Lego stuff that I've written, my purpose was always, it's family. It's what they call in the business four quadrant entertainment. Right. So it's for everybody. And I always try to throw bones to the parents. I always try to make something kids will laugh at. And I always try to put in references that only fans will get, because to me, that's right. That's close to my heart. So
that's the fun.
In the Lego Avengers special, I actually have a shot where I had Ant-Man get on the tip of Hawkeye's arrow when he fires him to chase down the bad guy. And that's right. I took that right from, I have it downstairs. I have a collector's edition copy of that Avengers comic book with that cover on it. And I did it specifically it was kind of for me, but I knew, you know, when I turned it in, my friend Court Lane at Marvel, who was running Marvel Animation at the time, goes, oh, this is, you know, he's much better with referencing that. Oh, this is Avengers number, whatever. He knew the number of the book. And I was like, yeah, it is. Right. That's where it's from.
That's cool.
Right?
That's very cool.
But then also, if you can sit down while you're watching the special and, you know, maybe you're building one of those Lego sets too, even better. Right.
Oh, that'd be a lot of fun. Actually, I never thought about doing that.
Yeah. I love building Lego sets.
Who doesn't,
building,
right?
It's a lot harder with the five-year-old, but I do love building them.
And it's just a relaxing thing. You know, I think the other thing that's neat, and you'll get here at some point, right, Kathleen, is that moment. It's both a proud parent moment, but it's also one of those where you go like, they're growing up so fast, where they finish the Lego set without your help. They can just look at the instructions and then get it done, right? And it's like, yeah. It happens to all of us. And it's like, again, it's one of those proud mm-hmm. parent moments, but it's also kind of like, right? They don't need my help.
I remember when my boys were old enough to not only finish building something on their own, but then they would tear it apart and rebuild it as something else. You know, they're like, yeah, we built right. that. I'm like, well, I thought you were going to play with it. He goes, well, my son looks at me and goes, well, I did. I built it. And then I wanted to build something else. I'm like, well, that is the joy of Lego. So, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. A big container of it, right, is so fun.
Oh, for years. We don't have kids that are small. I mean, my youngest is 17 now. I got a grandson coming up now. He's just born. But, you know, we've kept a bucket of Legos, you know, in our house for when other people's kids stop by. And I'm like, hey, you want to keep them busy? Here you go. Legos. Have fun.
Exactly.
You don't hear anything. When I came over.
Next time I'll get them out for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you put those out with the kids and you don't hear a thing. There's not a peep because those kids are busy. They're building, they're playing, they're using their imaginations, yeah. You know,
and so. And I had a ton of fun working on Nexonites. I actually got to go to the headquarters in Denmark and built at Billund in Denmark and, you know, really learn the history of Lego and really get into that. And that was a whole another great, fun, deep dive into that whole culture. And, you know, it's that's still owned culture, by yeah. the same family. And, you know, their how they founded it and the vision of their founders to, you know, steer into plastic toys after World War II. And a lot of people said, no, their biggest market at that time was Germany, because the Germans won't buy plastic toys. It has to be wood. And the patriarch was like, no, I'm buying. He bought the first plastic injection molding machines in Europe after the war to make toys, and then bought another one without telling his kids so that he could, because he knew this would be something.
And now their family's quadrillionaires, because that's what it takes to buy a Lego set anymore.
Exactly. So. Yeah. But it shows you, right? And yeah, in fact, I would always, if you look at a lot of my Lego specials, I think I worked it into the Frozen special. I don't remember, but I would always put in, one of the toys they were known for early on was, it was a wooden duck with wheels that you could pull the duck around, right? It was just a flower. Mm-hmm. And I would always try to put that, I would always try to put it into every little Lego thing I could do, just to, again, fan service, right? The people who know are going to know.
Easter egg. That's cool.
Right, exactly. It's always fun.
Yeah. Oh, Easter eggs are great. I mean, if you can, you know, being a big Star Wars fan as I am, I always love going through and spotting something, and it's like, you know, it's like, oh, I know what that's from. That's from this, you know. So that's always kind of a cool thing.
Like, as soon as switching Frozen and Lego, I'm like, oh, right, the Northern Lights special that I've seen about 9 million times.
That was really, that was really fun. Yeah, that was really fun.
It is a
and
really
we got fun. We got all the original voice actors on that, too. They all wanted to be involved. It was great.
Oh, that's cool.
I think you will have to pry Olaf from Josh Gad's dead hands. Like, I don't think that he's ever going to be done with being Olaf.
Josh was so, he had such fun, and he was so fun and gracious. And the thing I remember about that shoot is we were in the studio, and he would do a take as it had been written. And then he'd do an alt take, and I was feeding him alt takes, right? Oh, try this one. And oh, that's a good one. And he'd do it again as Olaf. And so it just became really, really fun. In fact, I think I still, somewhere around here, I have an Olaf Pez that I took on the pitch, but I don't know where it is anymore. Yeah.
That's cool. All right. So, hey, let's, changing up gears just a tiny bit here. Like I told you pre-show, we had done a little bit of digital stalking. Kathleen likes to remind me that we call that research. But according to IMDb now, which admittedly is the wiki of the entertainment world, and sometimes even the Weekly World Report of the entertainment world.
Yes,
it says that you are named as a writer for a show that's in pre-production called Mr. Burcham. And I was wondering what you can tell us about that show, if anything.
Well, I can't, since it's not out yet, I can't tell you a whole lot, but it was, so Adam Carolla, comedian Adam Carolla, had a character that he did years ago on KROQ here in Los Angeles called Mr. Burcham. And Mr. Burcham is he's a middle school woodshop teacher who's kind of a curmudgeon and doesn't understand the modern world. And so he's just taken that character and sort of translated him into a more modern sensibility. But that's the basic setup of the show. And so I was fortunate enough to get to work with Adam. I had a lot of fun working with him and working on this show. And so I'm kind of excited to see how it turns out. I ended up having to move on to some other projects.
Okay.
So I couldn't finish up with it, but I had a great deal of fun working with Adam. He tried to stay very true to that Burcham character, a man who just doesn't. And we all know people like that, right? He just doesn't get the modern world and kids and where things are going. And he's got a son that's a gamer, right? And so he doesn't understand this whole gaming thing and the whole, you know, you can sit in the basement all day and make money, right? You know, it's that kind of thing, which reminds me of myself. My son, when he was in college, was on the college Rocket League team, you know, and I was talking to him, and he's, oh, yeah, we beat Louisiana State, and I won like $500. And I was like, it's like 500 like real American dollars that you can spend on stuff. It's not like Rocket Coin or you got a special skin for your outfit. And he's like, no, Dad, real money. I won real money. I'm like, what is happening? Right. And so
real printed American currency, legal tender, valid at any bank.
Exactly. I was just like, what's happening? So that was my sort of Burcham moment of that. But it's, yeah, I'm kind of, happily anxious to see how it turns out, because like I said, this is a character that Adam's been doing for years. It's been near and dear to his heart. And if you ever get a chance, go listen to some of the old. So he would call into Kevin and Bean show on KROQ, and he would be Mr. Burcham, and he would be this. He would embody this character, and they would ask him questions, and he would always go on and on about. And of course, Adam made money early in his career as a comedian. He's also a contractor, so he would have, you know, very accurate stuff about the types of hammers and the types of table saws, and you know how you're supposed to put up the jib board and stuff. And so those recordings exist. And I think he might have done some Burcham on Crank Yankers also, the show where they would call.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Ooh, calls. He might have been Burcham on that. But his old Burcham bits are very funny. And so it's basically an animated take on that character.
Oh, okay, cool. All right.
So, I mean, Tim started out the interview with the getting to know your backstory. But I personally, I mean, after he'll do that question, then I'd like to, after you've reflected on your own backstory a little bit, I like to ask the question then, what sort of advice would you give to people who want to make the same career choices as you, who want to get into writing, or what advice would you give to yourself looking back at your career?
There are a couple of pieces of advice I give to everyone who I know who, and then I sound old, who's a young person that wants to be a writer. I always say, one, take a good financial planning class, because if you are going to make a living as a freelance writer, you're going to be working job to job, and you better learn how to pay yourself first and save your money, because in the down years, and you're going to have down years, it doesn't matter how successful you are, you're going to have down years, you're going to have to learn to save so that you can stay in the business. And I've seen people I know who've been shaken out of the business because they have a bad year and they have to go get a day job, and then they can't, you know, they can't write anymore. And you just really need to be good at that. The second thing I say is, please go take an improv class or a performance class of some time. If you can go do stand up, go do that. Because the other part of being a writer is you have to sell yourself and your ideas. So you're sort of out there. And I've seen writers that get up to make a pitch and they're like, this is going to be the funniest show you've ever seen. And it's very good. And we're going to have these, right? And you're like, oh my God, right. You know, this guy, I'd rather, you know, watch paint dry. And so you have to make presentation. You have to be fast on your feet. You have to be able to change stuff up and do things up. Now that also, those are supplemental too. You also have to practice writing. And the other thing I'll say is, if you want to write for certain shows, read scripts. You have to read scripts. It's a lot easier now than it used to be because of the internet, right? So if you want to get a script for an NCIS, let's say you want to do a procedural or you want to do a CSI, you can send away and get them. Back in my time when I was speccing, sorry, I just heard myself. Back in my day when I wanted to. Yeah, so when I wanted to spec.
Thank you, Mr. Burcham.
Yeah, when I wanted to spec a script, I would have to go. I think I was more Grampy Simpson than, you know, we would wear onions on our belts. There was a place in Hollywood where you could go and you could buy scripts. Or I also had a friend that worked at an agency. So I got to see a first Miami Vice script that had actually been produced because he provided me one. And the thing I learned about Miami Vice, and those of us old enough to remember Miami Vice always ended their episodes on the climax. In other words, someone would be shot and that was the end of the thing, and you'd cut to the Phil Collins song in the credits. Whereas any other show, somebody gets shot and you have the two or three scene denouement where we find out what the consequences are, the emotional attempt, right? So, and also there was a lot of music and a lot of panning and a lot of color and production art involved in Miami Vice. So Miami Vice scripts were only about 45 pages long. They weren't as long as a regular script, which was closer to 60. So I learned that, right? I learned that, okay, if I'm gonna spec for this show and I wanna look like I know what I'm doing, I have to know what that specific show format is. The other thing is, a lot of people, if you're speccing a script and they've worked on a specific show, they're gonna know, right? One of the things they're gonna do is they're gonna open the page and then they're gonna look, is it formatted in the proper script format? Like, is this someone who knows how to use Final Draft? And then they're going to maybe page through it and they're going to go to the back page and go like, is this page count appropriate, right? If I'm doing a 22-minute animated show, it's going to be right around 30 pages, right around 200 lines, right? That's a rough estimate of how it goes. You know, if it's prime time, right, it's going to be closer to, you know, 50 pages, somewhere between 50 and 60, right? And so, but again, some of that style varies. So read a lot of scripts. Take writing classes, right? I've written only one produced screenplay, but I've taken screenplay writing classes at UCLA Extension. I've taken sitcom writing classes at UCLA Extension just because, right, you know, and newspaper writing helped me. Having to learn to do journalism helped me to be succinct. It also helped me because in a lot of cases, you have to sit down and on a script cover, sometimes you got to write a log line or a synopsis of your script. How do you make it action, right? How do you pull out the to be verbs and put in an action verb right in the first sentence so that it sounds dynamic, you know? And those are just the little tricks you learn, you know?
It's good advice.
That is really good advice.
Yeah.
That was great advice. Especially so, you're just the now I started freelance writing last year. And because like it's one of those things I kind of came into late in life where I was like, oh, mm-hmm. I actually never thought I would be a writer of any stripe. And right. I started freelance writing. I've been writing for a couple different websites and I find that I enjoy it. And it's well more fun than I ever thought it would be. And it's actually very cathartic to be able to get my ideas and thoughts out of my head. So that was kind of cool, too. But what you were saying at the end there, you know, being able to learn how to write a synopsis, that is the trickiest for me. That was one of the trickiest things. How do I write a small synopsis of this so that I can entice people to want to read it? To, you know, so there's, you know, there's this, that little snippet, you know.
Well, that was, so when I did a lot of both journalism in high school and college, I was a feature editor on the college paper. And then when I wrote for publicity is basically feature writing with a slant towards sales, right? So there's sort of it's a mixture of marketing and journalism. And so for me, it was always, what's the lead, right? What's the good lead? What's the good dynamic first sentence that's going to get somebody to read the rest of this story mm-hmm. or bio or whatever? And is it you know, sometimes you can get a good lead with a question. That doesn't necessarily work for a script synopsis, but a lot of it is just, right, action verbs, right? What is it that's going to make it dynamic? And so a lot of that just takes practice and the ability to go back and look at it afterwards. You know, sometimes you're on a deadline, so you got to write, you're writing, you got to get it done. And sometimes you have to go back and go like, I could have made it better, right? And, you know, that's why a lot of times I like to leave myself at least, you know, if I have let's say I had a script due tomorrow, I would want to finish it today so that I could sleep on it and get up in the morning and go over it, right? And go like, okay, what did I miss? What did I not see? You know, how can I improve it? But I could look at that script the next, and I've done this. I go and look at that script next week and I'll have seen stuff that I should have changed, or that line would be better like this. Mm-hmm. And occasionally if I know it hasn't quite gone in yet, or if has, I'll call and say, can I make a couple changes? You know, Sure. Can I try to fix that up instead? You know, the other thing to do is, again, reading, whether you're reading scripts or you're reading books or you're reading, you know, there was a series of books I loved as a kid called Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators. And okay. they were mystery books like the Hardy Boys, but I just found them much more interesting. And one of the favorite examples I like, there was one of the books in the series was called The Screaming Clock. And the first sentence in the book was, the clock screamed. And I'm like, it's just such a succinct way to get you into the story that it's like, that's the very first sentence of the book, the clock screamed. And I'm like, I instantly wanted to know more. Even as a kid, I was like, okay, what's right. going on, right?
Oh, that's excellent. All right, Mark, we have enjoyed our time with you today, but we want to end on what we like to call our silly question. Uh-oh. Now, we ask you this question because Kathleen and I were talking and she pointed out that at a certain point in people's lives, people stop asking you this question, and we think it's a shame and that everyone should get asked this question. So, Mark Hoffmeyer, what's your favorite dinosaur?
Wow. I'll have to go with the classic Brontosaurus.
Ooh.
Just because of its gigundousness, right? And I always, as a kid, thought that, like, as much as you kind of like the Tyrannosaurus, I always thought it couldn't do things because of its tiny hands.
Yeah.
But the Brontosaurus, and also I think of that, there's a Monty Python bit where I think John Cleese plays a doctor that has a theory about dinosaurs, and the theory about the Brontosaurus is, it's small at one end, very big in the middle, and small at the other end. That is my theory. And so I've always just thought it was so silly and stupid. But it's also, when you read about the enormous size of it, it's almost incomprehensible, mm-hmm. right? How big these creatures were, and that it was eating leaves off of the tops of trees, and that it had to have a second brain in its hindquarters to help it move around like a fire truck has the guy steering at the back of a hook and ladder, right? It's the same kind of thing. So the Brontosaurus have always been fascinating. And also, it's so big. I guess you'd need a pack of Tyrannosaurus Rexes to bring it down, wouldn't you? I mean, its size is its own protection.
Yeah.
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. I don't think we've had anybody say Brontosaurus yet either.
Have you had a Stegosaurus person? Because I also like those.
We have had a Stegosaurus, yes.
Okay. We have had one Stegosaurus, yeah.
I'll stick with Brontosaurus.
All right. Good answer.
Love it. That's a solid answer. That is a solid answer. And very good reasoning behind it.
It's a solid dinosaur, too.
Yeah. Look, if you can work Monty Python into your reasoning, I'm always going to be there.
You're for it. Yes.
You sold me as soon as you said Monty Python. I'm like, all right, good. I'm good with that answer. Yeah.
It has a logic. Yeah. It
does. Exactly.
It does. Mark, thank you so much for being on our show with us today. Where can our listeners go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, you can. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me, you can read about me on IMDb. I am on Instagram. My Instagram handle is @HoffComedy, H-O-F-F comedy. And that's where you can see, learn about upcoming projects I have, or like I have a show in LA on Sunday night. So I always put up flyers for that. And that's the normal place to find me. I'm also out there on Facebook. So you can come find me on Facebook.
Awesome. Well, we will definitely link your socials so that our viewers and our listeners can find you, because you've got so much cool stuff.
Well, thank you. And you guys can find me too on the Instas. See, I know on the Instas, yo.
Exactly.
See how hip I am?
Yeah.
We're hip. We're cool. Anyway, guys, just want to remind you that subscribing is the most important thing you can do to ensure that we get more amazing guests like Mark Hoffmeyer here today. Go check him out on the socials. Go check him out on YouTube. I watched a bunch of his comedy stuff.
Oh, today, so no.
Those views, those were me. So go check that out. You guys will not be disappointed, but make sure to click like and subscribe on this video and go check out Mark's work. And you guys are going to have a whole heck of a lot of fun, because there's so much we didn't even get a chance to touch on. We could do like a mini series of Mark's career. Honestly, there's so much to talk about. But again, Mark, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you guys for having me. This was really fun. I always like talking about stuff.
Awesome. Excellent.
All right, guys, that's going to wrap it up for the FSF Podcast. Goodbye.
Copyright 2024 FSF Podcast. Reference to any specific product or entity mentioned on this podcast does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by FSF Podcast. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact us via email at info@fsfpopcast.com.